This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our first question this month is from Mary, who's in Cheshire here in the UK. And she wrote in to say, "Hello, I'm writing to you as there doesn't seem to have been any news about what I saw in the sky early this morning. I was awake between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. when there were four enormous flashes across the night sky. She can only describe them as a green sheet of light that lit up the whole of the night sky and also lit up the snow. And at the same time, there was a loud cracking sound which set off some home alarms. This made me very concerned and anxious, as I've never seen anything like this before. Hope you can inform me what this may have been." Well, I got in touch with Mary actually and just asked her whether it was cloudy or not when she saw this, and she confirmed that yes, there was quite a lot of cloud around at the time. In fact, very cloudy. And of course, it's been snowing here in the UK quite a lot over the last few weeks. So I sort of, one possibility for what effectively were described as green flashes is something called the green flash, quite well known in astronomy. It's possible to see this effect when the sun's setting or sometimes rising. And basically, it's an effect that results from refraction of light through the Earth's atmosphere. So as the sun goes down and you're seeing it through a lot of atmosphere, it's looking quite red because the blue light's being scattered out of the way. But as the body of the sun sort of disappears behind the horizon, for example, then what happens is the red light becomes progressively blocked, and some of the greener or indeed bluer light that's been sort of refracted through the atmosphere, curved around through the atmosphere, becomes the dominant colour. So you get this sort of brief, short-lived so-called green flash effect, which is quite hard to spot, doesn't happen all the time, but worth looking out for. Clearly this wasn't the case here, because she's talking about the whole of the sky lighting up and it was cloudy. It wasn't really an effect associated with the sunset. My best guess for this actually is that it was the effect of lightning basically in snow clouds, and there's certainly been reports of this before, is that there's a big lightning storm effectively. There's things called thunder snow, which is a thunderstorm where instead of falling as rain, you get the water falling as snow. And when lightning flashes there, basically because of the effect of that on the snow cloud, from the snow clouds, you get this sort of green lighting up of the snow clouds above you in that effect. So that's my best guess, at least. And whether the thunder actually caused the house alarms and things to go off is probably the explanation there. Okay, the second question is from Robin Patterson, who emailed in to say that they'd been looking at various discussions and looking at sci-fi movies and things, talking about what happened to people when if somebody went outside in space without a space suit, would they actually freeze when they went outside? And also whether they'd freeze if they went outside on Mars, for example, without a space suit, because of course the temperature's much colder out there. So this is the idea, that you go out in space or you go out on Mars, it's very cold, and therefore you're frozen. You're immediately frozen, and there's various sci-fi movies that show this sort of effect. Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that actually that's not the case. You wouldn't get frozen, certainly not immediately like that. And one thing to think about is what temperatures we're talking about and where the heat would go to from your body. So you've got to, if you're going to cool down when you go into a cool place, you've got to lose heat from your body. And there's basically a number of mechanisms for doing that. One of them is radiation. So the fact that you're warm means that you radiate away energy in the form of electromagnetic radiation, the wavelength of which depends on your temperature. So you've probably all seen pictures of a dark room, somebody in a dark room taken with an infrared camera, and you see somebody glowing, whereas in invisible light you wouldn't see anything. So at the temperature that the human body's at, most of the radiative energy comes out in the infrared part of the spectrum. So one way of losing energy is through that radiation process. Another way of losing energy would be through conduction. For example, if you were to you put a hot body in contact with a cold body, then the interaction between the atoms can actually transmit energy from atom to atom, and therefore take away energy from the hotter object and transfer it into the colder object. Another way is convection, which is, for example, the motion of a gas That's in contact with a hotter body or a hotter region of gas. So for example, in your home, in your room, you might have things that we generally call radiators, big lumps of metal that we pump hot water through generally. They're not really distributing energy largely by radiation, though it's largely by convection. So they get hot. The air in the room is in contact with them. That gets warm. And then because it's warm, it becomes buoyant, expands, it rises. And that means the hotter goes up, more cooler air comes in to be in contact with the radiator and then get warmed up and again rise. So you get this sort of convection motion, this sort of hotter rising and then distributing its energy and then cooling, coming back down, getting warmed again. Same process happens in the sun. Part of the interior of the sun, the energy generation just below the surface is via convection. The radiation from the core of the sun travels out and then and heats the outer regions. They get hot, they rise, and as they come nearer to the surface, they cool and they fall back down. So you get this sort of boiling motion that transfers the energy from the interior to the outer surface. In the case of the human body, that might happen with, you know, just being in contact with the air, for example, the atmosphere, and it's increased, the effect is increased by the motion of air, sort of forced motion of air, like for example wind. So if there's a wind, you get this wind chill factor because you're constantly bringing cool air into contact with your body to be warmed up and then taken away again. And the other possibility is evaporation. So so for example, that's why we sweat. So we put liquid out onto the water out of the surface of our skin, and that evaporates. And the change from a liquid to a gas actually causes that phase change, causes us to lose heat. So we're taking energy out of our body by that process as well. So there's those sorts of radiation, convection, conduction, and evaporation that would apply. Now, if you sort of went out into space, then in terms of your heat content of your body, it's basically a vacuum, not entirely, but it's a close to a vacuum. So a lot of those processes, say the conduction and the convection processes, require you to be in contact with something. So they're certainly not going to apply. So there's going to be some element of evaporation. And in fact, you know, that's an increased effect because there's a very low pressure in a near vacuum. The pressure is very low. And so actually you get the water vapor would boil very quickly. A pan of water boils more quickly if you take it to high altitude. So in fact, you know, the water vapor on your tongue and in your mouth and in your nostrils and so on, and your eyes and so on, would boil away quite quickly. And that would have a bit of a cooling effect. So you might get a sort of frosting on your tongue and in your mouth and so on. If you think about the radiation aspect, then basically, you would start to radiate away energy. And the interesting thing is that actually the rate at which you'd radiate energy away from being in, say, an environment where the ambient temperature around you is absolute zero, minus 273 degrees Celsius, 0 degrees Kelvin, the rate at which you transfer radiate heat away into that environment compared to the rate at which you radiate heat away into an ambient temperature that's like room temperature, say, 20 degrees Celsius, that's 293 Kelvin, it's not a huge difference. It's maybe 8 times faster, 10 times faster, something like that, the rate at which you're radiating heat away into absolute zero. So although you're going to cool down quicker by radiation, it's not instantaneous. It certainly would take time for you to cool down. You certainly wouldn't sort of step out into this vacuum and be immediately frozen because space is somehow cold. The other point about that, the other important point about that is, in fact, if you sort of took a body, whether that be a human body or some other type of body, and you put it into space in sort of Earth orbit, if you like, at the same distance from the sun as the Earth is, then in fact what you've got to remember is that in that sense space isn't cold really, because what's happening is you've got to remember that there's the sunlight impacting your body, incident upon your body, and that's going to heat you up. And actually you can work out that if you put a body in space at about the distance of the Earth and you allow for all the radiation it's going to absorb from the sun, and you assume it absorbs everything that hits it, and then you let that body warm up, and as it warms up, it starts to radiate itself. What you do is you work out the temperature at which that body gets to, where there's a balance, where there's an equilibrium between the amount of energy being absorbed from the sunlight and the amount of energy being radiated. And it turns out the temperature at which you'd get that balance is actually about 280 Kelvin or so. So about 7 degrees Celsius, something like that. So in fact, you could just sit any old body in space at the distance of the Earth from the sun and it would warm up to that temperature. if it behaves as what we call a black body, which is something that absorbs, is efficient absorber and radiator of radiation. So it's certainly not the case that you would freeze immediately. You wouldn't be very nice, of course. And the real problem is the low pressure, and what happens to, for example, internal organs in terms of the decreasing pressure, which would sort of bloat up. It wouldn't actually cause you to burst. It turns out the skin's actually strong enough for you to resist that sort of, so you're not going to sort of blow up and explode, as sometimes seen in sci-fi movies. But you would get sort of some bruising and so on as certain parts of you sort of inflate as a result of that, that decrease in pressure. The real problems are associated with the boiling away of water vapor. And also what happens to the oxygen in your blood. Because basically, as long as you sort of exhale quite quickly to sort of stop your lungs rupturing, basically, you could sort of survive for, it seems like, maybe 10, 30 seconds or so, maybe be conscious for several tens of seconds or so. But then you start to lose oxygen from your blood. And in fact, there's this process where actually, because of the change in pressure, the whole process goes into reverse. So you get oxygen being extracted out of the blood. And it seems that within 10, 20 seconds or so, actually you'd go unconscious because of that effect. You wouldn't freeze immediately. You don't cool down that quickly. But it wouldn't be very nice. In terms of what happens on Mars, well, I'm not so sure that, the difference on Mars is, yes, the temperatures, again, it's quite cold on Mars. The important thing, again, though, is that the pressure, the atmospheric pressure on Mars is something like 1% of the Earth's atmospheric pressure. So that's the crucial factor in this case. There's more of a chance of this sort of, little bit more of the chance of conduction or convection being an issue if you're in contact with a cold surface. So you can get a sort of, there's more of a chance of flash freezing where you're in contact with something very cold, and that can take away the heat quicker. But in general, it's the low pressure that's the problem. Okay, the next question is from Michael Muat. I hope I've got your surname right there, Michael. Michael's in Shetland, and he asks, how do Jupiter's satellites generate spots of aurorae at its poles? So, of course, the aurorae on the Earth, we know them as the northern lights or the southern lights, the aurora borealis and the aurora australis. So these sort of lights, glowing lights in the sky. And they result from particles, charged particles from the solar wind, streaming away from the sun through the solar system, interacting with the Earth's magnetic field, being captured by the Earth's magnetic field, travelling down the magnetic field lines and crashing into the upper atmosphere of the Earth. That interaction excites molecules in the upper atmosphere of the Earth to higher excitation, higher energy states, and then when they drop back down to lower energies, they emit photons of particular wavelengths that give you the particular colours you see in the northern lights. And it's true to say that Jupiter, for example, has its own aurorae, and there's some gorgeous photographs of Jupiter's aurorae taken with the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, with the ultraviolet camera on the Hubble Space Telescope. And there's also been some great work done on the aurorae with the flybys of Cassini-Huygens, and the Galileo spacecraft recently. And yeah, when you look at pictures of, we sort of take images of the aurorae that are near the poles of Jupiter, then you actually see bright spots in these aurorae that sit underneath the three of the four of the large Galilean satellites, Io, Ganymede and Europa. The brightest spot is actually sort of underneath Io. And then there's somewhat fainter ones underneath Ganymede and Europa. And actually, as the planet Jupiter rotates underneath these satellites, then these bright spots circle around and sort of follow underneath. They're referred to as the footprints of Io, Ganymede and Europa at Jupiter. And what it seems is happening is that as the satellite moves, the Jupiter, I should say, has got a very strong magnetic field that extends out beyond the orbits of these satellites. So the satellites are orbiting within what's called the magnetosphere, the region of space which is dominated by the magnetic field of the planet Jupiter. So as these satellites move through the magnetosphere of Jupiter, it's like moving a conductor through a magnetic field, and that can actually generate an electrical current. And that electrical current flows down what's called the flux tube, which is the sort of, if you imagine the magnetic field of Jupiter's like the magnetic field of a bar magnet, where you've got a north magnetic pole and a south magnetic pole, and you've got field lines that sort of loop out connecting these poles together. If you imagine the field lines that sort of exit the somewhere near the north pole of Jupiter, but at slightly lower latitudes, and head out, those magnetic fields that go round and through the satellite, and then back round to the other pole of Jupiter. That's the sort of flux tube that arcs around through the satellite. Then you basically get an electric current flowing down that flux tube and entering the ionosphere of Jupiter, and it's where that extra charge enters that you get this brighter spot in the aurora of Jupiter. And it's not, you know, it's quite a complicated process. It's not fully understood, and it seems that in the case of Io, it may well be enhanced by the fact that Io has all these lovely sort of volcanic effects, which are pumping ions, charged particles, into the magnetosphere of Jupiter. So that looks like that may actually enhance the effect. And also in the case of Ganymede, it looks like Ganymede has its own reasonably significant intrinsic magnetic field, and that again may have an effect that amplifies this effect slightly for Ganymede. But certainly lovely pictures of aurorae, of the sort of northern lights, if you like, northern and southern lights on the planet Jupiter, but also enhanced by their interaction with the satellites as they orbit around within the magnetic field, just like a conductor moving in a magnetic field. The next question here is from Sean, who writes in and asks that he's very interested in, he's thinking about going to university, he's very interested in astrophysics and cosmology, and he wants to know about employment opportunities and advice on what courses to study and so on that would leave him in a good position to apply for such employment. There's actually quite a good website that we'll link to from the Jodcast website that the Royal Astronomical Society produces, that has a sort of description on how to become a professional astronomer. In other words, how to get a job that pays you to do astronomy. It's a nice thing to be able to do. What you have to study to get that. And the standard route, and it's by no means the only route, but it's certainly the majority route, would be to study, make sure you're good at science and maths in particular at school. And then go on to university to study physics, typically, although there are related sciences that you can also get on to work in astronomy in. For example, it's possible to do chemistry with an astrophysical bias, or mathematics particularly, or maybe computer science. But the standard, the majority route would be to go through a physics undergraduate degree, then go on to do postgraduate research, a PhD, where you work on one particular subject for several years. It varies depending on which country you're in, but typically something like maybe 3 to 5 or 6 years. And then beyond that, you usually have to get jobs that are relatively short-term research positions, where you work on particular tasks for maybe 1, 2, 3 years at a time. And then eventually get to work usually in a university department or in at an observatory or technical establishment. That's the standard route to becoming an astronomer. But of course, there are always related jobs, the engineering jobs that relate in there, computing jobs that relate in there, where you can work within the context of astronomy or astrophysics at a related subject without actually being directly and astronomy yourself. So take a look at that. If you're interested in that, take a look at that Royal Astronomical Society website. The last question this month is from John Morell, who's referring back to something that happened during Jodcast Live at Jodrell Bank before Christmas, which unfortunately I missed because I was ill that weekend, but by all accounts was a great day. He says, the explanation of the formation of spiral arms given during Jodcast Live implies that the stars slow down when they join the back of the spiral arm and accelerate as they leave, just like a density wave on a motorway. Where does the force come from that causes the stars to slow down and then accelerate? Well, let me just give you the context of this. The problem with spiral arms, as we look at them in spiral galaxies, we see these lovely spiral patterns. But the problem is that when we've measured the speed at which the material in the galaxy moves as it orbits the centre of the galaxy, we find that speed is roughly a constant as you move farther and farther away from the centre of the galaxy. Now, to understand why that's a problem, perhaps let's think about a running track. Let's say where we get a set of athletes and we get this nice big circular running track and we draw a start line which runs from the middle of the running track out a longer radius towards the outer edge. And we line the athletes up all out along this start line, and then we fire the starting gun and we have them all run at exactly the same speed. What would happen is clearly the athlete on the inside has an advantage. To complete one lap, they don't need to run as far as the athlete at the outer edge of the track. And so very quickly they sort of spread out as they run around. That effect's called differential rotation, and it's what happens in a spiral galaxy because the rotation speed of the material is roughly a constant as you go out towards the outer edge. Now, if you had a spiral pattern that was fixed into the disk of the galaxy, then that effect would cause that spiral pattern to very quickly wind up. It would be the spiral would become incredibly tightly wound and effectively disappear. So we don't think that can be the case. We don't think the spiral pattern can be fixed to the stars and the disk. And the sort of most plausible explanation we have at the moment to explain this away is the spiral density wave model, where in fact the spiral pattern is not fixed into the stars and the gas and the dust. It's a wave that the stars, the gas and the dust can move through. And the analogy that was given in Jodcast Live for this is a good one, which relates to something I'm sure you've all experienced, which is if you're driving along on a motorway, on a highway, and then there's some sort of traffic jam, you see the brake lights go on in the car in front of you, and you put your brakes on, you all slow down, all the cars bunch up, and sometimes it's not even caused by anything, but maybe it's caused by an accident or even something on the other side of the highway that people are slowing down to look at. You all slow down, you go through this region of increased density of cars, and then you accelerate away again out the other side. And I guess if you imagine being in a helicopter and looking down at this from above, you would see this sort of bunching up of cars, this increase in car density. And that bunching up could actually be moving along the motorway in the direction of the cars travel, but the cars would actually be moving into the back of it and then out of the other side of it. Or it could even be stationary, or perhaps even moving backwards against the along the motorway against the direction of the motion of the cars. But the fundamental point of that analogy is that the cars move relative to that bunching, that increase in the density of cars. And that's what we think is happening with the spiral density wave pattern. It's an increase in the density of the gas, for example, that's moving around the galaxy. And as the gas is compressed, it can actually form a trigger star formation, form new stars. You get a mix of low mass stars and high mass stars. The high mass stars are very bright and often quite blue. When you look at a spiral galaxy, you'll see the brightest stars most obviously. So you see those bright stars where star formations occurred recently, which will be along this spiral pattern, along this density wave. You'll also see the sort of pinkish regions of ionized gas around the regions of star formation, these so-called H2 regions. So you notice the spiral arms where the star formations occurred recently, and it's that's moving around the galaxy. The stars actually, typically the stars are moving faster than the spiral density wave, so they actually enter the back of it and then they go out the other side. Now, with this particular question that John had, he was worried because he was thinking about the analogy of the traffic jam, and he's thinking, well, in the traffic jam, you slow down as you approach the back of this density wave and you accelerate as you go out the front of it. And he's thinking, well, how does that work for stars? What causes them to slow down as they approach the back? Well, in fact, that's where, you know, that analogy really breaks down in this case, because if anything, what would happen is that there's a mass concentration in the spiral density wave, and as the stars and the gas and dust approach the back of it, they'd feel a slightly stronger gravitational force and they'd accelerate into the back of it. And actually, as they came out the other side, the mass concentration would be behind them and they would then slow down as they come out the other side. But the crucial thing about the analogy is to do with the fact that a wave, the material can actually move through a wave. It isn't fixed to the material itself. And that's what solves the problem with differential rotation and the winding up of spiral arms. Okay, that's it for this month. If you've got any more questions you'd like answered, we'll do our best. And if you can send them in through the usual route, that'd be great. Speak to you again next month.